Anandasya Dhyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Padamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Parakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavanscha Sri Rupam Sadrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitantam Sujivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ladita Sri Vishakantitam Hey Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Evacha Putitana Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 63 Lord Krishna fights with Banasura Text 22-25. So we can chant together the first three, and then we'll chant responsively the last one.
Vidravite pute gane jhvarastu trishiras kripat abhyadhavata dhashaham dahani vadisho dasha.
After Lord Shiva's followers had been driven away, the Shiva Dwara, who had three heads and three feet, pressed forward to attack Lord Krishna. As the Shiva Dwara approached, he seemed to burn everything in the ten directions. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti quotes the following description of the Shiva Dwara.
Dwarasti parasti shiraha shadbhujo navalochanaha Asma prahano raudra kaantaka yamopamaha.
The terrible Shivadvara had three legs, three heads, six arms, and nine eyes. Showering ashes, he resembled Yamaraj at the time of universal annihilation.
Pata narayana deva tam drishtva vyasrijajjvaram Maheshwaro Vaishnavascha Yuyudhati Dvarabhubau.
Seeing this personified weapon approach, Lord Narayana then released his own personified fever weapon, the Vishnu Dwara. The Shiva Dwara and the Vishnu Dwara thus battled each other.
Maheshwara samakrandam vaishnavena balarditah alabha bhayam anyatra bito maheshwaro jvarah saranarti rishikesham tushtava prayatanjali.
The Shiva Dwara, overwhelmed by the strength of the Vishnu Dwara, cried out in pain. But finding no refuge, the frightened Shiva Dwara approached Lord Krishna, the master of the senses, hoping to attain his shelter. Thus, with joined palms, he began to praise the Lord. Purport. As pointed out by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, it is significant that the Shiva Dwara had to leave the side of his master, Lord Shiva, and directly take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna. Text 25, the word meanings, Dwara Uvacha, the fever weapon of Lord Shiva, said, Namami, I bow down, Twa, to you, Ananta, unlimited, Shaktim, whose potencies, Hara, supreme, Isham, the Lord, Sarva, of all, Atmanam, the soul, Kevalam, pure, Gepti, of consciousness, Matram, the totality, Vishva, of the universe, Utpatti, of the creation, Sthana, maintenance, Samrodha, and dissolution, Hetum, the cause, Yet, which, Tat, that, Brahma, absolute truth, Brahma, by the Vedas, Lingam, indirect reference to whom, Prashantam, perfectly peaceful. Jvara uvacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam gyapti matram. Vishvotpatti sthana sangrodha hetum yattad brahma brahma lingam prashantam jvara uvacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam gyapti matram. Vishvotpatti sthana samrodha hetum yattad brahma brahma lingam prashantam jvara uvacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam gyapti matram. Vishvotpatti sthana sangrodha hetum yattad brahma brahma lingam prashantam. Namami Tvananta Shaktim Paresham Sarvatmanam Kevalam Gyapti Matram Vishvatpatti Sthana Samrodhetam Yattad Brahma Brahma Lingam Prashantam Jvara uvacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam gyapti matram vishvotpatti sthana samrodha hetum yattad brahma brahma lingam prashantam jvara uvacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham
Vishvapattisthana samrodhetam yatad brahma brahma lingam prasantam.
Ladies.
Dvaruvacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam yukti matram visvatpatti sthana samrodhahitam yatad brahma brahma lingam prasantam. Namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam yukti matram visvatpatti sthana samrodhahetam yatad brahma brahma lingam prasantam.
Translation: the Shiva Dwara said, "I bow down to you, the unlimited potency of unlimited potencies, the Supreme Lord, the Super Soul of all beings. You possess pure and complete consciousness, and are the cause of cosmic creation, maintenance, and dissolution. Perfectly peaceful, you are the absolute truth, to whom the Vedas indirectly refer." Purport. Previously, the Shivadvara felt himself to be unlimitedly powerful and thus attempted to burn Sri Krishna. But now he himself has been burned. And understanding that Sri Krishna is the Supreme Lord, he humbly approaches to bow down and offer praise to the Absolute Truth. According to the Acharyas, the word Sarvatmanam indicates that Lord Sri Krishna is the Supersoul, the giver of consciousness to all living beings. Krishna confirms this in the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Matah Smritir Jnanam Apohanam Cha. From me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. In his commentary, Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti emphasizes that the Shivadvara has realized in many ways Lord Krishna's supremacy over his own master, Lord Shiva. Thus, the Shivadvara addresses Krishna as Ananta Shakti, possessor of unlimited potency, Puresha, the supreme controller, and Sarvatma, the supersoul of all beings, even of Lord Shiva. The words Kevalam Gyapti Matram indicate that Lord Krishna possesses pure omniscience. According to our limited understanding, we act in this world, but Lord Krishna, with his unlimited understanding, performs infinite works of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. As Srila Jiva Goswami points out, even the functions of the gross elements, such as air, depend on him. The Taittiriya Upanishad 2.8.1 confirms this. Vishasmad vata pavate. Out of fear of him, the wind blows. Thus, Lord Sri Krishna is the ultimate object of worship of all living beings. I like these verses where we have different names of Krishna. Gives you some guide to speak on. We have in our philosophy, actually, we're so fortunate because just the names of Krishna tell us so much about God. In other traditions, they don't even know a name of God half the time, or they have some vague name of God, like what Yahweh means, I am, or something like that. Doesn't really tell you very much. But we have, for example, Vishnu Sahasranam, 1,000 names of Vishnu. So you could take each one of those names and practically write a book on it. So we have so much theology just embedded in the names of Krishna, things that nobody else knows about. We have them all in code form, you can say. So much theology or information about God just in the form of his name. So here we're seeing something that's typical when someone's offering prayers to the Lord. They often mention several of the names of the Lord. glorifying him in that way. What we generally see is that devotees offering prayers, first of all, they offer glorification because there are different kinds of prayers. So generally they begin with glorification. And a lot of times it has to do with the majesty of Krishna, how he's everything, how he's the creator of this universe, and so on, his great power. And then eventually the devotees, sometimes they get around to making some requests for their own protection, for example, or whatever else they may be needing at the moment. Although generally we find in the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is presenting the highest philosophy, that devotees are asking for pure devotional service or just to remember the Lord, whether they escape material existence or not. So this Shiva Dwara, he is apparently quite a learned person. Of course, he's the Shakti of Lord Shiva, so what that means exactly, it's hard to say, but some kind of energy, we can say he... Of course, Lord Shiva, he's practically Vishnu. He's Vishnu in touch with Maya, a little bit discolored, you might say. Otherwise, practically, he's God himself. So he also has potencies, he has power. So this is one of his powers personified. And because he's a devotee of Lord Shiva, then he knows something, some philosophy. He's got his master, and he knows things. Of course, Lord Shiva, he has different kinds of followers. Some of them may not know so much. Some of his associates are these hordes of ghosts and goblins and whatever they are, all kinds of strange creatures. But they're faithful to him. We see how when in the pastime of Daksha Maharaj, or Daksha, when he, all those offenses went on back and forth, the cursing and counter-cursing and all that. And of course, when Sati went and she burned herself up because her father offended Lord Shiva and offended her. So then all those followers of Lord Shiva, they were angry. Of course, they accompanied Sati there also to the Daksha Yajna. Daksha had a few. There was the one that starts this whole pastime, the Daksha Yajna, where Daksha arrived and Lord Shiva didn't stand up. So that was completed. And then Daksha did another one, and he became more puffed up. Then he was doing another one, and that's the one that Sati was seeing. The demigods were going to this sacrifice, and she wanted to go. So her husband said, "No, you shouldn't go. It's not going to be good. I'm telling you, it's not going to be good." And she wanted to burn him with her eyes. She was angry. She wanted her way. Even though he was right, she was hell-bent on going. She really wanted to go. So she got angry, and she went anyway. So she just basically stormed out, said, "I'm going." And all the followers of Lord Shiva, they just went running after her and following her and put her on the palanquin and so on and accompanied her there. So they're not, you know, you might say the brightest creatures in the world, but they're dedicated. They know they're the servants of Shiva and Parvati. So they went there to serve her. But we see also sometimes that these followers, even though they're just like the Yamadutas, they look a little strange, but they also know a lot. In that pastime of Ajamil, the Yamadutas, when they're asked by the Vishnudutas, "Tell us about religion. You're the representatives of Dharmaraj, so you're supposed to know religious principles. So tell us about religious principles." So they speak really eloquently, actually. What they say is makes a lot of sense when you listen to it. You say, "That sounds really good. I don't hear any problems here." They sound like they've been trained by their master. But when they get done, the Vishnudutas say, "Oh, how horrible. These people who are supposed to be representatives of religion, they don't know what they're talking about," essentially, is what they say. Of course, what they said was right, except it was a little subordinate to the highest principle. They were missing one important thing, that Ajamil had chanted the name Narayana. So whatever he had done in the past, that was all forgotten. So all these rules that the Yamadutas knew, they kind of went out the window because of that one thing. But in any case, they were trained. They were, although they're so fierce and horrible, ghastly looking, they knew about religious principles. So this Shivadvara, also strange-looking creature, three legs, I keep thinking, three legs. Never heard of a creature with three legs. I mean, we're always, you know, everything is, what is the, I don't know, there's always this symmetry, usually. In nature, there's symmetry. There's always, you know, right side and left side. If you have two legs on one side, you have two on the other side, and so on. And the Vishnudutas have four arms, not three. So I wonder about three legs, how that works. It's like a pedestal, like a tripod. You know, it has stability, but it doesn't seem like it's going to move very well. Of course, spiders have five legs, and they seem to do just fine. If you ever watch a spider move, you think, wow, imagine the coordination required to move all five of those in sequence somehow, what to speak of a centipede. Well, Krishna gives every creature some kind of intelligence to do things. But in any case, we have this strange creature with three legs. What is it? Three heads. Was it three heads? Yeah. Three heads, six arms, and nine eyes. So each head has three eyes too. So an imitation of Lord Shiva, I guess. He has three eyes also. So he's really strange looking. And of course, fierce too. Intensely fierce. He could conquer anything. Practically anything. But he couldn't conquer the Narayana Dwara. But he comes before the Lord, and all of a sudden, the eloquence comes out, starts glorifying the Lord with these amazing prayers. Namami Tvananta Shaktim. Now this is important. He says, you have unlimited potency. Here I am, I'm the potency of Lord Shiva, and I think I'm powerful, but you have unlimited potency, as you've just demonstrated, this potency of yours in the form of this Narayana Shakti. Narayana Dwara, he's more powerful than me. He's burning me. Of course, Narayana Dwara is cold. Prabhupada gives a whole elaboration of this in the Krishna book where he talks about it. He says, you can tolerate heat, but you can't tolerate cold. And maybe coming from India, he was a little biased. Some people say, I can't stand the heat. Cold is okay. But Prabhupada said, no, ultimately, cold will overcome the heat. So that's what we see demonstrated here, at least in this pastime. The cold was more powerful. In fact, Prabhupada says at the time of death, fever goes way up to 107. Then it drops down. One thing that's it's quite striking, it's not something we do often, most of us, but if you ever touch a dead body, that what's quite striking is how cold it is. You expect it to be like room temperature, like the same temperature as the bed. But you touch the bed, then you touch the dead person, it's like, whoa. It's really surprising, actually, how cold a person feels. Now, maybe there's a psychological aspect to it. I don't know. Maybe the temperature is the same. But the experience is, this person is really cold. So, ultimately, the cold prevails at the end. The Prabhupada uses that as an example of how cold is overpowering even heat. So, Krishna's Ananta Shakti, this is one demonstration of it in this form of Narayana Dwara, unlimited potency. He also calls him Para Isham. This word Isha is very important for us. It's Prabhupada's challenge to those who would say that we're all God. Isha means the controller, Isha or Ishvara. So in one sense we are Ishvara, controller, but not Para Ishvara or Para Isha. Not the supreme controller, the ultimate controller. And in fact, when you get right down to it, we really don't control much. Pretty much we don't control anything. We're given a little credit, we're maybe tiny controllers. In the prayers by the personified Vedas, this point comes up. It's okay if you can control a little something, you can take some credit for that, but don't think you're the supreme controller. This is God. He's the supreme controller. And this is how Prabhupada would challenge. You say you're God, but are you in control? He would often say, the God is getting a toothache. He's saying, I am God, but then he has to leave his talk because he has a toothache. So, or I answer the call of nature. That's how much God we are. Actually, our existence is so precarious. I think of this often. In fact, it's in the three Shaktis of Lord Vishnu, Avidya Karma Sangyanya, the third one, Titiya Shakti Rishyate. The third one is Avidya Karma. So Prabhupada, in speaking of this in one class, he says one of the characteristics of the third energy, the material world, is that when you're in it, you have to work. Things just don't come to you. In the spiritual world, everything just comes. But here you have to work. And in fact, you have to work just to stay alive. You can't stop. Imagine, I was thinking it's like some doomsday science fiction movie. Like every hour you have to punch in some code into a machine or the whole world blows up. If you don't keep doing it, the end is going to come. So basically that's how we live. We don't keep feeding this machine, pushing the right codes, putting food into it, then the end is going to come. Whether the world ends or my world ends, what difference does it make? Sometimes I think of this, people are so afraid of some cataclysm that's going to destroy everything. But what difference does it make? If somebody destroys the whole world or destroys you, the result is the same for you. You're dead either way. The experience is going to be the same for you. But that's our situation. What kind of controllers are we? If we don't keep, running, Sharira yatrapi chate na prasidyera karmana. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, you can't maintain this body without working. So that's what kind of Ishwaras we are. We're so dependent. Conditioned souls, Prabhupada used that, his term, conditioned souls. And this, unless all these conditions are met, then we're gone. So we're, and then Krishna's in control of the conditions. We're not. So we're so dependent. So to say we're God is craziness. Now on the other side, we're all God, actually. That's true. Ekam Brahma Dutiya Nasti. Everything is Brahma. What's Brahma? Brahma is God. Ultimately, there's only one thing. There's only God. That's what the Vedas say. Now the impersonalists, of course, they hang their hat on that. That's what it says. Tattvamasi, Soham, so on. All these different slogans from the Vedas that say everything is God. And you say, how can you deny? It says right there in the Upanishads, there's only one. There's no two. There's no duality. Everything is one, God. So that means I must be God too. We're all God. Now our argument to that, our counter-argument, or Vyasadeva's counter-argument in the Vedanta Sutras is, that's okay, but you're not taking all of the Upanishads. You're forgetting all of those slokas of the Upanishad, or teachings of the Upanishads that talk about the other side. Dva Suparna Sayuja Sakaya. There are two birds on the tree. There are so many verses that talk about duality. There are so many words just like this one. Paresha or Parameshwara. So why have the word Parameshwara for all Ishwara? No, there's Ishwara and there's Parameshwara. We find this duality everywhere. So somehow you have to reconcile these two. You can't just take one and throw out the other one. So that's, of course, what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did. Chintya Beda Beda Tattva. I was trying to think of this philosophy graphically the other day. It's like you have you have one circle, you say that's A. Then you have another circle, you say that's B. Of course, the impersonalists will say, well, there is no B. Or that B circle, you have to put like a dotted line around that circle. Because it's sort of there, but it's not really there. So what we're saying, this is why it's a chintya, because logically you say, well, A is A, and B is B, and B is not A. We're saying B is not A, but actually, no, B is A too, at the same time. So we have this logical contradiction, and that's why we say it's a chintya. How can it be that it's both A and not A at the same time, or A and B are simultaneously one and different? But they are, and why do we accept that? Vyasadeva's conclusion, because the Upanishads say so, and the Vedas are a Paurusheya. We have to accept authority, and we accept the authority of the Vedas. Of course, that's our final answer, definitive answer. We accept what the Vedas say. And we accept, of course, achintya, that God is inconceivable. So in any case, I was thinking of this in relation to this Paresha. There, it implies that there are two. There's Isha and Paresha. Now, we also have this Kevalam Gepti Matram, the totality of consciousness. And this is also related to the previous part here, Sarvatmanam. We're Atma, but Krishna is Sarvatmanam. This is connected to the point I was just making about how we're all God. We, maybe because we come in the line of Madhvacharya, we like to think more of the distinction. I am the Jiva, Krishna is God. So there's this separation here, an eternal truth. But we are one also. We are part of Krishna. And that we shouldn't forget either, because, of course, Maya thinks I have no connection with God. And even in other religious traditions, God is so transcendent and so different from us that it's like hard to figure out what the relationship might be. But we have such an intimate relationship with Krishna that we are, in a sense, Krishna. We're part of Krishna. We're part of God. We are God, in a sense. Prabhupada actually says that in some places. In one sense, we are all Krishna. We all are all God. So this can actually be inspiring to think. Because when we hear how great God is, then we can think, wow, I'm actually part of that greatness. Now, I'm not, obviously. I was singing the other day how sometimes people criticize, especially when you take the mood of subordination in spiritual life, in humility, and people think, well, you have no self-esteem. But I was thinking, no, actually we do, because we think we're part of God. That's pretty high esteem for yourself, isn't it? They're thinking that they're this body, and the body is like this, it's gone in the perspective of eternal time. It's like a spark, it's a lightning flash, it's gone. There's an infinite amount of time before you were here and an infinite amount of time after you're gone. For one brief moment of time, infinitesimal moment, you exist. How much self-esteem can you have if that's who you are? How great are you if you think you're this body? But we're eternal, so that's much better. And Sarvatmanam, part of us, our essence, actually, is God. God is, in one sense, infusing us. Of course, we hear in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am and I'm not at the same time. We always have these different paradoxes. But still, that is an essential part of our being. So there are a few other things here, but I just wanted to mention the last point that's made by the Shiva Dwara, is that the Lord is, you are the absolute truth to whom the Vedas indirectly refer. Now, this is an important point because people study the Vedas and they don't find Krishna. They don't even find God, at least God the person. It's so overwhelming, actually. The Vedas, it is quite overwhelming. Unless you have a guide, there's so many things there. And people can't make sense of it. And even the scholars, of course, they have their certain prejudices. What you find in any, practically in science or in any field of academic study or mundane study, there are always fundamental assumptions that can't be proven. And a lot of times, everything grows from these assumptions. So if your assumption is wrong, then probably everything that's grown from your assumption is going to be wrong, too. Just like, for example, one of the things that Vedic scholars assume is that because there's different kinds of Sanskrit, that means that has historical meaning, that this Sanskrit is older. So the Upanishads are older because the Sanskrit language in the Upanishads is different from the Sanskrit language in the Puranas. But we say that's not necessarily so. In fact, what we say, now they may even historically, there may be some truth to that when they were, written down. We know Vyasadeva, there's a certain chronology there. But on the other side, all of these are eternal. The Bhagavatam is eternal, the Puranas are eternal. These personalities, their personalities, they're eternal. The Upanishads are eternal. And because they don't all speak the same, does that mean that they came in different times? No, it's because they're speaking to different audiences. That's why we have different languages. Even we ourselves, when we speak to one audience in one setting, time, place, and circumstance, we may phrase things differently. Audience is a big concern of mine as editor of BTG. I'm always trying to figure out who the audience is. So when you speak to one type of person, You speak in a certain way and you speak to someone else. You speak to your child, you don't speak the same way you do to, you know, someone in college, obviously. So the Vedas, this is one of the arguments that our Acharyas give. That's why we see a difference in the language. But that doesn't mean necessarily that that it has chronological significance. So the other thing about the Vedas is, so this is one thing that people misinterpret. My point was they make certain assumptions, and then from those assumptions they come to certain conclusions. So they, one thing they say, they put more importance on the Upanishads because they say these are original. And then later, and they, in the Upanishads, of course, the oneness is emphasized a lot. So when the Puranas come and we see this more devotional aspect, then they think, oh, this is just less sophisticated, basically, is the idea. The Puranas, they're for ordinary people. They couldn't understand this deep philosophy of the Upanishads. So tell them all these stories, and mythology, and so on, and keep them in line that way. Teach them, you know, how to behave themselves through these stories, because they couldn't understand the philosophy. So in any case, the Vedas are so vast that people get very confused. But in certain places we hear that, no, actually there is a unified whole there. There's a verse in the Harivamsa, Vede Ramayana Chaiva, Purane Bharate Tata, Adavante Chamadjecha, Hari Sarvatra Giyate. Harivamsa is an appendix, you might say, to the Mahabharata. So it says there that in all the Vedic literature, Ramayana, Mahabharata, and others, from the beginning to the end and in the middle also, only Lord Hari is glorified. Only Lord Hari is explained. Hari sarvatra giyate. But you can't see him necessarily unless you have guidance to see him. So there's one verse when Krishna speaking to Uddhava, and he says something like, I enjoy the way the sages speak of me in indirect ways. Essentially, that's what he says. He makes a point, something like that. The sages speak of me in indirect ways. They give hints about me. So Krishna likes that because he reserves, as Prabhupada says, he reserves the right of not being exposed to everyone, especially the rascals. He can keep himself hidden. So the Acharyas and the Upanishads and the Vedas in general, throughout the Vedas, Krishna is sometimes obscure, not so easy to find. But the pure devotees, of course, they can find him. They can find him everywhere, in every word. We hear that the Bhagavatam is Krishna in every word, every syllable. When I read the Bhagavatam, I say, I'm always thinking, what does this have to do with Krishna? It seems so mundane. There are certain parts of it. And I think, what does this have to do with? Where is Krishna here in this syllable, in this word? But the pure Vaishnavacharyas, they're able to see Krishna everywhere. And we see examples of that sometimes in their commentaries, how they reveal Krishna, who seems to be hidden behind the curtain sometimes of the language of the Bhagavatam, even, what to speak of other scriptures. So this is another point that the Sri Vajrayana is bringing out here, that Krishna is indirectly referred to throughout the Vedas, although he's there everywhere. All right, I'll read the translation again. The Sri Vajrayana said, I bow down to you of unlimited potencies, the Supreme Lord, the Supersoul of all beings. You possess pure and complete consciousness and are the cause of cosmic creation, maintenance, and dissolution. Perfectly peaceful, you are the absolute truth to whom the Vedas indirectly refer. Questions or comments? Let me look over here first. Madhumati, Mataji.
Thank you for that enlightening point about the language that the Acharya mentions, that it's actually for different people. I mean, I always thought that the Upanishads, that's what I read, you know, that the Sanskrit is different because it's written. So one thought I was thinking, yeah, you can see in the Bhagavad Gita, the Sanskrit is such much more simpler than even the Bhagavatam, and it seems like it's written during the same period. The you know, Mahabharata and the Puranas. So the question was that, so when do our acharyas say that the Upanishads were written?
When were they written?
Yeah.
They're eternal, so they weren't written. And then Vyasadeva put them into writing. Well, did he write them? I don't know. I mean, I've heard that he actually didn't write them. I think Vida Ananda Maharaj makes this point. He didn't actually write them, but he consolidated them, put them all together into and you might say in an encyclopedia and categorize them in different ways. So they're eternal. So their language is eternal. So it's like we can't look to a certain time in history and say, well, that's the way they were speaking Sanskrit back then, and that's why they come out this way. At least that's yet not the explanation that's given that I heard. It's like, no, it's actually because of different audiences.
So then who was the audience for the Upanishads? And who is the audience?
The Upanishads are written more for the sannyasis and vanaprastas. You know, we have Aranyakas. So what is Aranyaka means somebody who's living in the forest. So those who have given up, basically renounced life, and are living separately, and they're really in a dedicated search for the absolute truth. Just like this picture we get of the sannyasis in Prakashananda Saraswati in Banaras. So their idea is you can't actually study Vedanta unless you give up everything first. But Lord Chaitanya said, no, everybody, doesn't matter who you are. You chant Hare Krishna, study the Vedas. So, but that's the idea. That's especially meant for that class. Now, if you read Vedanta Sutra, of course, you'll see, you know, who could understand it? Unless you're thoroughly versed in the Upanishads, you can't understand Vedanta Sutra. Because Vedanta Sutra is a commentary on the Upanishad. And a lot of times Vedanta Sutra will just quote a few words. So unless you know where those few words come from, you can't figure out what the context of the discussion is. So this is really for the scholarly, more scholarly persons, the Upanishads. And it's true that the Puranas, we look at the Puranas, what are their stories? And interspersed in the Puranas are lessons, spiritual lessons. Even the Amala Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, is full of so many stories. As I was saying, some of them when I read, I think, oh, what does this have to do with anything? You know, this woman is seducing this man, you know, a whole chapter in the fifth canto. What does this have to do with Paradharma? But somehow it's there to connect us to Krishna. So anyway, that's the point that's made. So the Puranas, we know the personified Vedas, they exist, they're eternal associates of the Lord. Just as we exist eternally, they exist eternally, they're persons. So that's the language they speak. Actually, I heard the Gopi Pranadanpuru points out that the Bhagavatam contains some Vedic Sanskrit. Now, generally speaking, these Sanhitas, the Vedic Sanhitas, they have to be, not only do you have to get the pronunciation right, you have to get the tone right, the key. There are at least three different keys, you can say, that you chant them in. And if you don't chant it in the right key, that's like mispronouncing it. So it has to be done so properly. So you have to be highly, highly trained to chant Vedic. Much of the Vedas, of course, there's the Sanghitas, which tend to be more slokas, we say, like poetry. But there's a lot that's also in prose. So in any case, you know, they're very difficult to understand. But the Puranas, they're meant to be, they're simpler. And the Gita and the Upanishad. Now we say that Vyasadeva, getting back to the original question, our general understanding is that, yes, Vyasadeva wrote them down. He wrote them down 5,000 years ago. That's what we say, about 5,000 years ago. Vyasadeva wrote down all the knowledge was already there, but he put them in writing so that they would be available for Kali Yuga. And Bhagavad Gita was written around the same, of course it was spoken, Bhagavad Gita was spoken in one sense, it wasn't written. Vyasadeva wrote it apparently after the Mahabharata war, because he's relating the history of what happened. So that's, you know, 5,000 years ago. 3102 BC, you want to be exact, I think that's the date, isn't it? That's when the Mahabharata war was supposed to have taken place. That has to do with some astrological calculations.
So the Ramayana and Mahabharata, we understand that it was written for, described, Prabhupada describes for women and
Shudras.
And so then the Bhagavatam, the Upanishads are for the, you know, the forest dwellers. But then we see the Bhagavatam, that is for, it seems like it's also for the jnanis and everybody, because when Shukdev spoke, we see all the audience that was there was very elevated, and the describes the how the women and the children, they left, and all these great souls were sitting.
They tended to be men, although it was a mixed audience philosophically, we know that.
Yeah.
And because there were rasik bhaktas there, pivata bhagavatam rasamalayam, drink the nectar of the Bhagavatam. And we know in the first verse, now supposedly these first three verses were written by, first the whole book was written by Vyasa, but it's mostly just spoken, you know, Shukadeva and Suta Goswami and so on. Most of it is, it begins with Suta Goswami who tells the whole thing, but the first three introductory verses are said to be, have been written by Vyasadeva. So Vyasadeva says, Nirmatsara, that's the qualification to hear the Bhagavatam, is to not be envious of Krishna. So there's supposed to be some purity of the heart, purity of desire. If you really want the highest truth, if you're done with projita kaitava dharma, if you want the real thing, then read the Srimad Bhagavatam. So in that sense, it's for everyone. And now, of course, historically we tend to see this distinction between men and women, and maybe there were just men in the audience, but over time, of course, that changed. It was given out to everyone, and it's meant to be understood by everyone. The Bhagavad Gita also, everyone can understand under proper guidance. Of course, that's the key. No one can understand it without proper guidance. With proper guidance, anyone can understand. Srivikrampur?
Yatta Paramahamsanam. Kunti Devi was preaching that you come here to preach to the Paramahamsa. How can we women understand what you are saying? Do you remember that? Anyhow, the Upanishad seems to be taught and explained by the disciples of the main acharyas like Srila Vyasadeva and Parasa, and these other great personalities. Their disciples, they were famous for different Upanishads and stuff. The Puranas, even though the Bhagavatam is the most important, but all the Puranas deal with the five fundamental subjects: creation, annihilation, the kings in the Solai dynasty and the Moon dynasty, and the geography. All the Puranas have to deal with this, really. But Bhagavatam, of course, is considered the Amala Purana, special.
Well, it also has 10. Any Purana has 5, but a Maha Purana has more, has 10. Ten subjects.
10 subjects.
Actually, what you were talking, I was thinking, I thought this before too, that it's said that the Vedas are the mother and the Puranas are the sister. So your sister maybe speaks to you differently than your mother also. More familiar way, less authoritative. The Vedas are more authoritative and heavy, you might say, and direct. Whereas a sister may present the same instructions in a friendlier way, more user-friendly. That's the Puranas. Jamashtami for them. It's not on. It's not on, I don't think. Switch?
Can you hear now? Yeah, I'm sorry. There's a question about the wide range of Shaivites. There's the mystic sages. I just want to get your take on this. There's the mystic sages.
Sounds like something I never heard of, but go ahead.
No, that's one of the, these are one of the list of people that have accompanied Lord Shiva, you know, to come to the
in
battle.
In this chapter, you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh, uh-huh.
Mystic sages.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you go to chapter 88 of the 10th canto, the people worship Lord Shiva for material opulence. Of course, that's another material opulence, mystic cities. And then it seems nowadays, many of the Shaivites end up somehow they're being impersonalists. And I don't quite get that one, where, unless it's Panchopashana. But,
well, everyone's an impersonalist today. Vaishnava impersonalists too.
So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, how all this connects.
Well, it's just like Lord Vishnu has all kinds of followers too. Akama, sarvakamova, mokshakama, udaradi. In fact, I was just reading, I was doing a little online research about Advaita Vedanta. And one place I came across the idea, they were saying that Shankaracharya, he liked the idea of bhakti as a path, even though he was an impersonalist. Because we know that there are those many who think that bhakti is just a path to oneness, to merging, ultimately. So that's at least one interpretation of what... Because we know, for example, we say, oh, Madhvacharya said, Bhajagovindam, Bhajagovindam, Bhajagovindam. So what? We always think, well, what did the Mayavadis say and his followers? So this is one thing they probably say. Yes, he may have been promoting bhakti, but ultimately to merge. Bhajagovinda, so you can become Govinda, ultimately. So there are all kinds of followers of Shiva, just they're all kinds of followers of Lord Vishnu. They have different motives, what it comes down to. Now what we see in the Bhagavatam in several places is Lord Shiva's sitting and speaking about Lord Vishnu, speaking the Bhagavatam essentially, to great sages, to Narada Muni. Actually at the end of this Daksha pastime, when Lord Brahma and all the demigods go to apologize to Lord Shiva, so Lord Shiva is sitting there in the Virasana. He's preaching, and at his feet is Narada Muni, listening. So he's all obviously not preaching impersonalism. He must be preaching Krishna Katha, Krishna Bhakti. So he's a preacher, so he does what he can. Yena tena prakarena mana Krishna veshe, somehow or other, bring people to Krishna. But he's a teacher. He has his sampradaya, Vaishnava sampradaya. And right, Rudra Sampradaya is coming from Lord Shiva. So he's pointing people to Lord Vishnu worship. But he gets other kinds of people and he has to engage them in other ways. Now how it all gets twisted around, well, it's, you know, Kali Yuga, the culture. Now all the Shaivites, they all smoke ganja and so on. I was hearing Prabhupada saying how his father used to give ganja to the sadhus. The boys were asking him, Prabhupada, what? Prabhupada said, my father didn't make any discrimination. He said, his mood was whatever the sadhus want. Not that he approved of it, but that was his mood. I'm the host, so whatever they want. So they want ganja, and I'll give them prasad and a little ganja as, you know, dessert. So Lord Shiva's like that also. Whatever they want, I'll give. But he's trying to give them Krishna, ultimately, because he's Vaishnava. Vaishnavana Amita Shambhu. All right, well, we're shot the mark here, so we'll stop. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.